Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things that they run on? And that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass just whatever legislation they like. They are bound by the Overton window. This concept, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. Politicians typically only act within a narrow window of policy options. And on the Overton Window podcast, we talk to people who work to shift the Overton window and change what is politically possible. I'm Mike Van Beek, and joining me today is Alex Cartwright. Alex is one of the Mackinac Center's Board of Scholars and previously was an Associate Professor of Economics at Ferris State University in Big Rapids, Michigan. He is now principal at Hotel Shift, a company that converts hotels into apartments. Alex, thanks for joining us.
It's exciting to be here, Mike. That's a great intro, and happy to talk about not just real estate, but how we are working to shift the Overton window, because I certainly think about what we're doing as being a little bit broader than just quite literally giving people an affordable place to live.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about the background of Hotel Shift and how you got into this business.
So there's two ways to answer that question. Number one is I'm just an entrepreneur at heart. And so when I saw an arbitrage opportunity in the real estate space, I wanted to create a business around it. And here's the arbitrage opportunity. Apartments are very expensive because there's a lot of demand for them. There kind of always has been and always will be. And they're increasingly difficult to build just for a variety of reasons. Interest rates are high and construction costs are labor costs, material costs are high. So it's difficult to build new housing. It's difficult to build new housing that's affordable. At the same time, hotels, I'm painting with a very broad brush, but there's a lot of distress in the hotel world. And especially if you look at older hotels, at some point in time, a hotel's not worth remodeling anymore. And the Marriott or the Hilton or the Holiday Inn brand that was originally on the hotel, it just goes on a new property down the street. And the 30-year-old hotel, maybe it slips from being a Marriott to being a Super 8, and then it's a Travelodge, and then it's kind of a mom and pop branded hotel, no longer associated with the franchise. There's not a lot of demand for those on the buyer side. Not a lot of lenders that are comfortable with those. It's a difficult business to operate, very labor intensive, small margins, and hence those buildings can be purchased very cheaply. And if we can buy those buildings cheaply, change the zoning to multifamily, those buildings are often in great locations where rents are high. They're near where people work. They're near major highways and transportation hubs, and they can become great apartment complexes. And we can afford to rent those apartment complexes out at rates that are very competitive because we bought the hotel very cheaply. Hotels already have a bathroom in every room. They already have individual HVAC systems in every room. They're meant to hold a lot of people. It's the architecture is very akin to a multifamily building already. So our business at its core is buy a hotel at a very cheap price, convert it to multifamily. That requires construction, but it's really just a zoning change. Once that's done, now all of a sudden the money that it makes gets a much higher multifamily multiple put on it, and the value of the property heavily increases. But to your broader point, and maybe more interesting to this podcast audience, is I would obviously kind of a free market guy being affiliated with you all and teaching economics. And I would talk to my students at Ferris all the time about buying real estate when they graduated college and thinking about budgeting, things of that nature. And you know, at Ferris, we kind of I don't mean this in a negative way, but kind of a vanilla business school in the sense that it's representative of lots of other students around the country and around Michigan. A lot of first generation students, most popular majors, business administration. And so your student that graduates with their business administration degree, maybe they go and get their entry level job and they get paid 40, 50 grand a year. And they say to themselves, I'm not going out and buying a new car. But at the same time, I don't want to have a roommate anymore. And maybe they move to Grand Rapids and, you know, all of a sudden 30 to 40% easily of their post-tax income is gone to rent. That's $1,300 to $1,500 a month with utilities. And this is not even for a fancy, luxurious building. And then those same students that just graduated, my concern is that they sit down and they say, well, I've done everything right. And this socialism stuff just doesn't sound so bad because here I am trying to save money and get ahead, but 40% of my income is gone to rent. How do I save money? How do I think about planning? Like, I'm just not motivated to get ahead. And there's these a lot of narratives out there that the rich are getting richer, landlords are evil, these people are underpaying you, charging too much, right? All these very zero-sum narratives of the economy, and high rent just feeds right into that with these young people. I mean, look at what has gone on in New York, right? What is Mamdani's main talking point? Is rent control, housing affordability? Young people rank this as amongst the most important issues to them. And at the end of the day, like a lot, voters do make a lot of decision with their pocketbooks. And this is most people's biggest expense is housing. There's this really interesting stat that I don't remember it specifically, but that there's a term in the real estate industry called rent burdened. And so people are considered rent burdened when they're spending more than 30% of their income on housing, and they're considered severely rent burdened when they're spending more than 50% of their income on housing. Well, right now we've got a record number of people in both categories and a record percentage of Americans in both of those categories. And almost half of those people are people that are earning between $50,000 and $75,000 a year. It's not just the people at the absolute bottom of the income earners. All kind of people that are even middle income spending significant amounts of money on housing every month. And there's really no good solution to that. It's expensive to build, even where they will allow people to build. And the government's got all kinds of subsidy programs, low income housing tax credits. The state of Michigan's got a variety of subsidies, but as you well know, that's fundamentally just taking money from taxpayers and handing it to developers. That's not actually making housing cheaper. And by the way, when you just give somebody government money to buy housing with or to build housing with, they don't have any incentive to do it efficiently. So you can find any number of articles and different research that's been done about how expensive it is to build affordable housing in any major city. You can find affordable housing that is built at a higher price per unit than the market rate housing. So I see us as a solution to that. Like here we are getting rid of a distressed hotel in a town and that distressed hotel is probably not paying a lot in taxes. It's probably attracting crime and a transient element that the city does not want. We are going to clean it up and end up paying more in property taxes. And then we're going to do very well for ourselves and our investors. And we're going to rent units to people where at prices that are, our units range from like $895 to $1,200 a month with everything included, even the internet. And that's a solid 20-ish% cheaper than the cheapest units in the market. And we've done all that without needing anything from the government except permission to rezone. So we're not a charity, but I'm really proud that we're the free market of affordable housing, right? And this is a scalable, sustainable solution to getting more low-priced housing in the hands of the people that need it.
What makes it so difficult for builders to erect affordable housing units? I mean, why do we have to go about this? I mean, why aren't you just building new affordable housing units instead of doing this, which to me seems a little more cumbersome, of converting hotels into apartment buildings? Like, what are the factors that are involved there?
I'll tell you the factors, but before I do that, I just want to tell you like order of magnitude numbers, okay? So with land, and to build apartment units right now, no doubt $250,000 to $300,000 per unit, Okay. Just order of magnitude. Take that. We just bought a hotel in downtown Denver for $29,000 per unit. I understand that's a hotel room and we're going to have to do some work on that. That's an almost 400 square foot hotel room with a balcony on every building, underground parking. Like, it's going to be a very decent B class apartment. And we're going to spend about $40,000 a unit renovating it. So you say we're all in with some holding costs about mid-70s to $80,000 a unit. I mean, this is still like one-third the cost of new construction. So before I tell you why, just order of magnitude, we are way cheaper, right? I mean, I'm effectively producing the same product for a solid 60% less than what new construction guys can produce affordable units for. But to give you a sense of the economics of new construction, you got to think about the fixed costs that are involved. So what do I mean by that? I mean things that are the same price no matter what you develop. So no matter what you develop, whether that's a workforce apartment, sometimes we call it a C-class versus an A-class luxury apartment, you know what you got to do? You got to do an environmental study, okay? That's got a kind of a fixed cost to it. You got to get the architects involved. Okay. Well, the architect is not that much more money if they're designing a luxury apartment versus a workforce apartment.
Sure.
And even when it comes to doing what we call the underground construction or the horizontal construction, you got to install the sewer lines. Okay. Got to install the electricity, all the utilities. Just doesn't change that much if it's a luxury apartment or if it's a workforce apartment. You got to pave the parking lot. Got to put some shingles on the roof. You got to have a plumber run the lines and install toilets. And while the finished materials are certainly different and on a luxury apartment, the luxury apartment is going to be a little bit bigger than the workforce apartments, there's a lot of fixed costs that are the same. So as the cost of labor and materials goes up, it becomes more profitable to go ahead and build the luxury apartment. It's actually the margins on the workforce stuff are squeezed. Right. So that's why the only stuff that gets built right now is nicer apartments. And then in terms of renting something for $1,000 a month, there's no way to make money to spend $300,000 on a unit and rent it for $1,000 a month. Just the math is not even close to working.
Yeah. Now you've been at this for several years now. And I'm wondering, what are some of the regulatory barriers or challenges that you've faced trying to convert these hotels into apartments?
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to negotiate with architects and with city planners and city council folks to try and get around those barriers. There's a lot, but I'll put them into a couple big buckets for you. One big bucket is that there's just a lot of, let's call it NIMBYism or not in my backyardism. And that is to say that folks are very much against development of any kind in a lot of cases. And I know people wouldn't necessarily characterize themselves as anti-progress, but they want their neighborhood to continue to look like the way they remember their neighborhood and the way they think it should feel. Okay. And I mean, it's difficult to convince cities that we need to have more multifamily in general. There's a real prejudice against people that live in apartments. They're not going to be part of the community. They don't care long term. They're not paying property taxes. Of course, the owner of the building is paying property taxes. They're just overrunning the schools and using the public services, and they're not good long term citizens. There's not a lot of good data to back this up, number one. And number two, I don't know that philosophically it even matters, right? So that's a big problem. And like I said, that people just don't want more stuff to be built. The way the neighborhood is now is the best possible case, right? That's how they remember it for the last 20 years that they've lived there. Please don't change my neighborhood. Now, of course, everyone likes to see all the development in big cities and new skyscrapers go up. And if it's 10 miles away from them, well, it's great to see the new mall going in and the new restaurants, right? But in my neighborhood, no, needs to stay how it is. Don't change the rules. this is just, I know I got to be careful because it's recorded. I don't want to be too unfiltered, but I'll be a little unfiltered with you. It's just ridiculous to me that let's say you own a single family home and all of a sudden, and our zoning laws in most major cities are such that because you own a single family home, what happens a quarter mile away, you get a say in. It's craziness to me that somebody that owns a home gets to say how somebody down the street uses their land to build an apartment or retail store, etc. It's like people just have economic amnesia. Okay. There's not going to, if those people are wrong about how they're what they're going to develop on their land, they will incur losses and they will be punished. But cities will not let entrepreneurs take risks when it comes to different types of real estate development, which is just bizarre. And a handful of very vocal citizens can unfortunately grab a lot of power in these cities and really dictate what does and does not get developed. I want to just give you, pardon me to give you a, I know I'm being a little long-winded here, but pardon me for just a second. I want to tell you something very interesting. So now I live in Dallas, okay? And it's a very high growth place by some measures, fastest growing city in the country, certainly in the top five fastest growing cities in the country. And if you go to suburbia Dallas, you know what they open every single year? Schools, because you got so many people moving, so many houses getting built. You go to lots of North Dallas suburbs. There's 3 and 4 elementary, middle, high schools opening up every single year. It's exciting. And then you go to Plano, Texas, which is a huge suburb of North Dallas, and they're closing schools. But you go 3 miles north to Frisco, Texas, and they're opening schools. It's like, why are we closing schools here and opening schools 3 miles away? And if you look into it, it's because the NIMBYs have taken over Plano, and now the only thing you can build is a $1 million house. They don't want any more multifamily. And the folks that have young kids that are just getting started, that are in the earlier stages of their economic life, they can't afford to come in, so much so that now they're shutting down elementary schools and people are having to move elsewhere. That's a pattern we see all over the country. And it's just that would never happen if there was a real free market for what gets built where.
Yeah. So what, so NIMBYism is, the geologists, what about like government policy at the local level and the zoning? I assume you have to go before the cities and
I do
zoning changed and approved.
There's some other,
how does that process work?
I'll tell you about it. There's some other ridiculous rules that I asked them to exempt me from, and I have to very politely tell them that their rules are ridiculous. One ridiculous rule that we encounter sometimes is there these egregious parking requirements where they will say something like, you've got to have 1.5 or 2 parking spaces for every unit of multifamily. Now, a hotel is not designed to run at 100% occupancy like an apartment is, right? So a hotel may only have 1 space per unit or less. Whereas an apartment, it might have a lot of 2 and 3 bedroom units. You need some guest parking. And so the code is such that with multifamily, they often require 1.5, 2 spaces or higher parking spaces per unit. And I say, guys, why does it matter how many parking spaces I have? Okay. I understand not overcrowding a street in front of the property or next door. But we can make an agreement on how much street parking. That's not my property, right? How much street parking we're allowed to use. But if I have a 100-unit hotel, and I have 105 units of parking or 120 units of parking, why are you involved? If I don't have enough parking, my rents are going to suffer as a result. Maybe people that live in our apartment use a bus. Maybe they carpool. Maybe they walk to work. And then sometimes I get frustrated. I ask them, when Walmart builds a store, do you ask them how many cash registers they're going to put in the front? No. Does anybody even know? Is there any code you have to have this number of cash registers per square foot in your Walmart store? Of course not, because if they're wrong, they're going to lose money as a result. They're going to determine, hey, we only want to hire this much cashiers because that's the most profitable model for us. Why can't I decide how many parking spaces my units have or minimum unit size You've got to have a 400 square foot unit. I'm like, God, what? Can't we have a 350 square foot unit? Maybe you don't want to live in 350 square feet, but there are some people that earn $40,000 a year, need to pay $800 a month, and they're fine with 350 square feet. Why don't you allow them to make that trade-off? And so sometimes I joke around with the city planners politely, and I say, but don't you want to require dishwashers? Don't you want to require granite countertops? Well, why not? It's nicer. They should like it. And I try it in there. But of course, the broad point is you've got people that have this power over what gets built and what it looks like, but they don't bear any of the cost. And ultimately, that means that the more affordable units do not get built. Sometimes I'm able to sit down and reason with these people, show them that our intention is not to be slumlords and that we're providing a niche product that does not exist in the marketplace, and they're willing to work with me, but sometimes they're not. And whatever they say on TV behind closed doors, I don't want to be too specific, but like leaders of major municipalities have said to me, I am a hard no on affordable housing. I don't want to be known as an affordable place to live. I don't want people with lower incomes dragging down our bond rating and calling the police and overrunning our schools. We like that it's expensive to live here and that the property values are high and that people are paying a lot in property taxes. It's good for us economically. And at some point, I have to give up. Right?
Yeah.
So Texas has got this great law, my opinion, great law. Wish they had it in Michigan too. We haven't run into big problems in Michigan, but we have in other states. It's called SB 840. And what that law says in Texas is that any property except industrial, any commercial property, if you want to change it to housing, you're allowed to rezone it to housing. City can't get in your way. Isn't that cool? It's just a state law. Now, cities have tried nonsense, like you have to have a dog washing station. You have to have 30% of your parking spaces for electric cars. You have to have multifamily. It's at least 5 or 6 stories tall. These are all veiled attempts to make housing less affordable. But as a baseline, right, in Texas, you're allowed to convert anything to housing. And Florida's got something very similar. I hope it's adopted in more places.
Yeah, wow. I would think that you would have a pretty strong, negotiation with the cities, because you are proposing to convert something that is not doing much economically and maybe is an eyesore, and you're going to take something and improve it, and they. Even then, they don't. Some city planners. Well,
that's right. Not if it's affordable, okay.
Luxury apartments, they'd be like, yeah, okay, that sounds good.
Yes, right. Okay. So this is why I'm very careful. I mean, I'm honest about it, but I'm very careful to keep using the word workforce housing, not capital A affordable housing, which in real estate communicates that it is somehow directly subsidized by the government. But I say, no, this is workforce. It's like C plus, B minus housing. These are folks that maybe they work at the Amazon warehouse. They're managing retail stores. They don't have a lot of disposable income, but they're not on government assistance. That's who's living here. And most times I can get the city on board with that. But you talk anything related to affordable housing, again, no matter what they say in public, they're terrified of it. That's a bad word to the city planners.
Yeah, wow. So you've got a couple units in the works now. You've got, I think, one in Denver, right? And tell me more about just kind of where else you're operating.
Yeah, sure. So I'll give you some background about Denver just to illustrate how neighborhoods change. We bought in Denver a 310-unit hotel that was a Holiday Inn. And it used to be next to this airport called Stapleton Airport. I say used to, not because the hotel moved, but because the airport moved. So now in Denver, the airport is much further outside the city. It moved about 20 years ago, and there's no longer enough demand to sustain a 310-unit hotel. So this is a great situation of where it's not the case that the hotel did anything inappropriate. It was professionally managed. It's not the case that the city enacted some stupid policy and drove business away, the neighborhood just changed, right? The needs of the city changed as the airport grew and moved. It's time to repurpose the hotel. So we're able to buy that hotel at a wonderful basis, and we're converting it into 240 apartments. They all have balconies, which is pretty cool. And the hotel is 11 stories tall. You're not allowed to build multifamily 11 stories tall. So it's cool that we're able to provide that density and cool views for the residents. And in the city of Denver, they've been very helpful. They actually have an office of adaptive reuse encouraging this kind of project. Adaptive reuse, meaning repurposing different structures. And so they've been very supportive of that. And we're going to have construction going on that project in the next 60 days.
How long does it take the construction phase of converting the hotel?
So that it depends a lot on the hotel. This one in here is pretty complex, being 11 stories tall. It's got a big atrium in the middle of it. It's got underground parking, indoor outdoor pool, 3 underground racquetball courts. We're putting in a golf simulator, 2 fitness centers, and of course 240 apartments is quite a bit. So that is 16 to 18 months of construction before we start leasing. On other hotels that are more of what we call an extended stay hotel, so they've got a kitchenette in ready and we're just expanding the kitchen, that is more of construction time there can be more along the lines of 12 months, but it takes some time, right? It takes a good 6 months of planning and doing what we call pre-construction before purchase. And of course, I don't want to own any old hotel as a hotel. So we're only getting the zoning change. We're getting the zoning change before we purchase it. And so that's a good 6-8 month process before purchase. And then you've got construction time for 12 to 18 months before we're leasing.
So you've talked a lot about how you could offer more affordable rents to workforce housing, maybe 20-30%, but just describing that Denver hotel, it made me think, golf simulator and swimming pools and gyms and all these sorts of things. That's like, that's the kind of thing that a luxury apartment building would have, right? It's like, it's almost as if you're like finding a middle ground between, providing luxury amenities at affordable rents.
Yes. So we've got kind of 2 categories of product. We'll call one our B-, targeted at a young professional. And that's what the Denver property is. That hotel is in a nice area. It's in the architecture is such that it makes sense to target a young professional that cares about those amenities. And that hotel, frankly, already had a bunch of amenities that we're just repurposing. So that's got way more amenities than, for example, I've got another hotel that's right by the port of Houston, and it's next to Exxon and Chevron's main refineries. That is targeted at more of a blue collar tenant. We'll call that a C-class property. And that property doesn't have the amenities, but it's also cheaper. Right. So it just depends on the architecture of the hotel and the neighborhood, whether it's we need a more affordable product for the more blue collar, we'll call them workforce folks, or the young professional white collar kind of folks.
So we just have a couple minutes left. Looking forward here, you mentioned Texas and Florida have some really good laws on the books that make this easier to do. What do you think the future looks like? Are there going to be other states kind of joining Texas and Florida and trying to make an effort to increase affordable housing? Or do you think NIMBYism is going to derail or, provide too much of a barrier for many states?
Yeah. Frankly, I am shocked that the law in Texas is what it is. And just because it is so market oriented, I don't know that kind of thing will be contagious to other states, but I certainly hope so. I'm not a political pundit. I have not heard that the Texas or Florida style laws are up for consideration in other states. There's a big push to have more affordable housing in other states, of course. And what a lot of other states have done, like I know in New Jersey and in California, is they've just simply mandated that the municipalities find a way to create more affordable housing, either through subsidies or rezoning, et cetera. So there are some cases where we'll go have a conversation with a California municipality or a New Jersey municipality, and they'll say, yeah, this will help us hit our affordable housing mandate. And so that at least seems to be working in our favor, even though it's not, doesn't quite have the latitude and the teeth that the law like Texas and Florida has. A battle that we are fighting right now that the Supreme Court has struck down is sometimes when you do new construction, you have to pay what's called an impact fee. So for example, you might pay $20,000, $30,000 per unit for the city to set up the sewer or pave the sidewalks or make an investment in the school, since you're going to be providing a lot more students in the school, something like that, like a one-time investment when the property's built to expand municipal services. So Florida, some cities in Florida have gotten abusive with these impact fees. And all of a sudden, the impact fees are hundreds of thousands of dollars a unit or tens of thousands of dollars a unit, millions of dollars for the project. And the Supreme Court has come out and said, look, if you're going to charge impact fees, the impact fee can't just be a tax. It has to be actually connected to the impact. So if you charge 10 grand per unit, you need to show this is why we need 10 grand per unit. This is where it's getting spent. So I think that Supreme Court decision is going to help long-term as cities roll back the egregiousness of the impact fees. Only some cities were abusing this, not everybody. But the other thing in terms of the future in other places are friendly. And it does not take a lot of arm twisting. For example, they've been very friendly to me in Grand Rapids and in Metro Grand Rapids. We just have not found the right property. We've got offers on a couple properties there. I hope the stars line up. And there may not be enough people like me that are running into the red tape to where this is even on the radar of state legislature yet. But if there was a blanket law, we would aggressively look for more properties in the state that passes laws like Texas and Florida.
Yeah. Well, great. Thanks, Alex, for being on the Overton Window podcast. That's all the time we have for today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the invite.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.